This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I'm Chris Cipone. This is Dark Shining Moment, the story of how Russia messed with the United States in 2016, its people, its politics, and its media, from the perspective of those who noticed it first.
We were like, Jesus, how big is this stuff going on here? It was shocking to me.
Last time, Phil, working on a contract job for the reconstruction effort in Afghanistan in 2008, stumbled into a string of websites that catered to conspiracy theorists and fringe perspectives. Things as varied as aliens and UFOs and 9/11 truther sites, all with the notion that reality itself couldn't be trusted. But there was something else very strange about these sites.
We noticed how, when a message changed on a certain subject, like NATO's expansion eastwards, for example, the messages on a group of varied websites would change as well. We saw how obscure, pseudonymous websites all moved together, like a school of fish.
Phil only stumbled into these after Googling the narratives of his Russian colleague. Those words took him to a string of conspiracy websites. Why, Phil wondered, was his colleague Alexei repeating narratives that echoed, sometimes to a word, what was on these sites? At the time, Phil and his colleagues agreed that there was a pattern to the messaging. But what? And why?
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Many years before Donald Trump would enter the White House in an election that shook the world, Ronald Reagan was president of the U.S.
Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
And Reagan's presidency formed the backdrop of my adolescence when I was growing up in Texas.
Austin, Texas, a dynamic city long known for its quality of life and scenic beauty, is today the fastest-growing metropolis in the South and Southwest United States.
It was a different world. The Texas suburbs seemed to extend forever in wide paved roads, leading to endless tracts of housing, all with expansive yards. The summers were long and hot. Our reality was more or less bordered by what was available on TV, on the radio, in books, and at the movies. We got glimpses of the bigger outside world, and sometimes you could make out details of other places on the nightly news, sometimes in movies. Song lyrics by bands like The Clash and Steely Dan hinted at the wider world out there. I recall the Olympics offering a look abroad for us stranded in the middle of the wide continent.
Hello, I'm Jim McKay, reporting from Sarajevo, where we'll be from now until the closing ceremonies ring down the curtain on these 14th Winter Olympics.
Where I lived, it required a day's drive to get out of the state. Back then, at least where I was, it was unusual to meet someone from England or even, dare I say, Australia. But to meet somebody from the Soviet Union was akin to meeting somebody from Mars. It was that fearsome place of May Day parades with huge missiles rolling through Red Square and gigantic paintings of Marx and Lenin. Even though the Cold War was still on, maybe a bit like the Soviets, by the time we were growing up, no one really believed the rhetoric. Around this time, I was at a New Year's Eve party. I remember it was bitterly cold outside. Inside, the heat made the apartment toasty. Music blared. My friend Matt and I learned that someone had brought their exchange student friend, an actual Russian. You see, the Reagan era had turned into the George H.W. Bush era.
During these last few months, you and I have witnessed one of the greatest dramas of the 20th century, the historic and revolutionary transformation of a totalitarian dictatorship, the Soviet Union, and the liberation of its peoples.
And through no effort on our part, the Soviet Union was opening up, a period called Glasnost. In the spirit of Glasnost, which we heard about on the nightly news, we thought to introduce ourselves to this Russian guy. What were the chances of meeting someone from the Soviet Union in Texas? So we introduced ourselves to him. The word was that he was a general's son. He stood with his back to the wall, eyeing us. He didn't engage in the excessive smiling Americans were known for. So I ventured the obvious question.
How do you find the U.S.? Do you like it?
Then, with much effort, he replied that he didn't like it.
Do you like the people? No. The food? No. The beer? No.
Then he offered the unsolicited opinion that he thought American women were loose. He watched us as he said these things, as we deciphered his replies, which were lengthy and delivered in halting English. His liquid blue eyes were wary, but trained on us, checking our reaction. The Russian, or I guess Soviet, he wasn't budging. He didn't like America, and he made no mystery of the fact. The encounter clashed with the gauzy talk of glasnost we heard so much about on the news. Matt and I looked at each other, then turned back to him.
All right, dude, see you later.
By which we meant, see you never again. If in life behind the Iron Curtain, nothing happened and everything mattered, in the U.S., in the years to follow, everything seemed to happen and nothing would seem to matter. It was the 1990s. Without the existential threat provided by the Soviet Union, capitalism in America, well, it was finally unleashed. More tech and internet firms came to Texas. There were ever more ways to communicate. Just across town, before he became famous for denying the Sandy Hook shooting, or even before he appeared on RT as a journalist, local Yahoo, Alex Jones, had a show on community television.
Hello, caller, you on the air?
Yes, Alex, how you doing?
Pretty good.
Indie music flourished, and this would continue undisturbed for years, right up until
Tuesday, 9:47 a.m.
Hi, baby. I'm on a plane that's been hijacked. I'm on the plane. I'm calling from the plane. I love you. Bye.
The Kremlin's return as a power in the 21st century wasn't easy to see. Not for a lot of people. Russia's resurgence in the West would occur in the cracks and seams in our society. One person, watching these spaces, who saw it was Andrew Weisbird.
On my tax returns, I described myself as a provider of expert services to elements of the U.S. government.
Weisbird's story begins in the fateful days following September 11th, 2001. The attacks were, for Andrew, a New Yorker, personal.
How did you first get into the position where you found yourself in 2015, starting to track Russian bots, trying to help Trump?
Everything starts with September 11th, and my own personal response to the September 11th attacks was ultimately to... I sort of declared a one-man war against Al-Qaeda on the internet.
Andrew's aunt had been responsible for hiring and training people at Cantor Fitzgerald, the investment bank located in the World Trade Center. On September 11th, she lost about 150 friends to Al-Qaeda's terrorism. Working in IT, Andrew discovered how Islamist terrorist groups would find unsuspecting websites to host their material. Working from his home office in a medium-sized university town in Illinois, he matched wits with terrorists. Jihadists would break into other people's websites, creating hidden subdirectories, then go to jihadi forums and spread the link around. Andrew would flag the jihadist presence with hosting companies, alerting them that they were unknowingly providing services to terror groups.
I started out blogging information about terrorist websites, doing open source research on who was providing them with services. The people who do the technical support stuff for terrorist organizations, part of that involves doing things like setting up public websites. And so they expose themselves. You can't have a website on the public internet and not have some degree of exposure.
Andrew says he works in the space where...
the covert and the overt meet, that I've been taking advantage of for almost 20 years now.
In his one-man mission to report Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, and other Islamist terrorist groups to the companies inadvertently hosting them, his tactic was daring but effective. It involved identifying people who wanted to inflict violence on America and then recording where they were on the internet. Andrew did this as a hobby, outside of his own work in IT. It wasn't long before his blogging about jihadist websites attracted the attention of the jihadists themselves.
And they would all come to my website. Frequently, this would start with somebody posting a link saying, you know, the evil Jew is saying something terrible about us, and here's a link. And people would, of course, click the link and leave log entries in my log files. So I would know that people at this, that, or the other pro-Al-Qaeda website had just, you know, clicked links and come to visit one of my web pages.
Eventually, maybe predictably, Andrew's own website on jihadists was targeted by a denial-of-service attack. It was flooded with so much information, it was shut down. But thanks to the attention brought to him by the attack, he was approached by an NGO asking him to consult in a newly emerging area, helping law enforcement track Islamist terrorist groups on the internet.
So at a time when I kind of sort of needed a new day job, my counterterrorism hobby became my day job.
Andrew found that law enforcement and intelligence didn't have the capability or the will to sift through domestic private sector websites. American law enforcement and hosting companies could take action against terror groups, but for different reasons, they were extremely reluctant to do the searching themselves.
The FBI was, you know, I mean, well, the U.S. government has a hard time dealing with anything on the internet because of the First Amendment.
The First Amendment to the Constitution guarantees the right to free speech.
People like to look down on U.S. government agencies and they get a bad rap, but the fact of the matter is, at least from my experience, is they're highly aware of and sensitive to First Amendment issues.
The technology evolved. So did Andrew's work. He moved from tracking terrorist-related websites found on hosting services to tracking the content of terror groups on social media. He started to work with a small group of partners.
And, you know, I came to be referred to by some people as like the poor man's NSA, because I would come up with solid leads, solid technical intelligence, that normally only organizations like NSA would get, unless, of course, you're willing to pick a public fight with Al-Qaeda, in which case they would, you know, come after you and leave log entries.
Over the years, Andrew developed a working relationship with the FBI, which, he says, was a source of amusement to his friends. Before embarking on a solo war against terrorists, Andrew says he had a long history in left-wing environmental activism.
My background was basically sort of progressive, ranging to paranoid as far as the U.S. government went. Somewhere along the way, after about 10 years, so around about 2012, I had the opportunity to shift focus from working on Sunni extremists, Al-Qaeda, and so on, to working on issues related to Iran.
A funny thing about the Iranians...
there's a very close relationship between the Iranians and the Russians, particularly at the level of information operations or influence operations.
On the streets of a war-torn Aleppo, Syria, soon a low-flying fighter jet, then what sounded like a burst of machine gun fire. The dead and dying arriving at a nearby hospital.
So when Russia and Iran moved to support the Syrian leader, Bashar al-Assad, amid a civil war in his country, Russia and Iran's state-backed social media trolls heavily pushed these narratives. The U.S. offered tepid support for rebels, but ultimately, the U.S. and West's response on the ground was limited. However, online, pro-Kremlin media wildly overstated Western aid and support. On Russia Today...
if it hadn't been for foreign intervention, there would be no civil war going on in Syria. The decisive factor in the equation of civil war is U.S. military intervention. We know this now. And I would say, frankly, the Obama administration is guilty of war crimes against the Syrian people, having manipulated, cynically manipulated the situation.
the Russian and the Syrian and the Iranian line is that you either support Assad in Syria or you're Al-Qaeda or ISIS. There is nothing else.
At every turn, pro-Kremlin accounts portrayed the civil war in Syria as a Western-driven event. Russia-linked social media accounts and pundits then began churning out lies that further inverted the facts on the ground. Syrian rescue workers helping recover victims of bombings? They were terrorists in disguise. Children and women killed by poison gas? They were crisis actors. The traditional news reported reality as best as they could. The social media accounts linked to Iran and Russia proclaimed a competing reality. Andrew, at first, struggled to get his head around what he was watching.
The experience of almost anybody who looks at Russian influence operations, Russian propaganda operations, is that first it's like you're not sure you're actually seeing the Russians doing it, and then you're like, you think you're seeing the Russians doing everything, and then you start thinking you're crazy because, like, the Russians can't be doing all of this. And somewhere after that, you figure out, yeah, the Russians actually are doing an awful lot of this, maybe not all of it, but an awful lot of roads tend to run through or lead to Moscow.
While the West wanted Assad to step down, they thought long and hard before launching another war in the Middle East. Yet on social media, the civil war in Syria was described as a proxy war between the West and East. Did these messages flash across the networks of websites Phil and his colleagues mapped in episode one? You bet they did. Did automated accounts or bots help spread these messages? Yes. And the effect on the thinking for segments of the digital public was like magic. Maybe black magic. With proper framing on social media, with enough persistent voices, the blame for the atrocities in Syria was reassigned from Assad and Russia to NATO and to the U.S.
Hands off Syria! Hands off Syria! Hands off Syria!
The conflict and confusion on social media spread. This success in backing Syria and the effectiveness of Russia's propaganda would go on to encourage the Kremlin. Australia's former ambassador to Russia, Peter Tesh.
I used to describe that as the reverse pottery barn rule. We broke it, but you own it. We've helped destroy civilian infrastructure, you know, the bombing of Aleppo, but we're not going to have any role in rebuilding any of this. So we're just going to hand you this steaming pile of ruins, and it'll be up to you if you think that poses an ongoing threat to your Western interests. Well, good luck with dealing with it. And I think that, along with Georgia in 2008, the series of so-called color revolutions and Maidans in Ukraine, I think the relatively muted response from the West, as viewed from the Kremlin, provided ample reinforcement to the Putin view that these people will go to water if we push them hard enough.
Ваши командиры вам не дадут ни квартиры, ни денег. Простатит заработаете. У такого доктора, как я, будете лечиться за деньги. Потому что меня поставили в такие и не вылечите. А потом у вас будет...
To understand why people close to the Kremlin and the Kremlin itself thought they could get away with such an ambitious and brazen act, you have to understand what they pulled off in Ukraine about a year and a half before the U.S. election began. Even as the war raged in Syria, in Ukraine, there is a movement to topple their president who had defied the public's will and sought to move the country closer to Russia. Demonstrators gathered in the streets of Kyiv, but on social media, something was shifting.
And all of a sudden, all these people who had been just pro-Assad boosters do like a 180 and are suddenly experts on Ukrainian fascism and the importance of fighting Ukrainian fascism.
Crowds of angry Ukrainians took to the streets to seek the overthrow of the pro-Moscow government. Online, the trolls, bots, the fringe and conspiracy websites, and semi-official channels depicted the protesters as an extension of NATO, rather than a naturally occurring group. The assembly of pro-Kremlin voices weighed into the history of Ukraine and Russia in a most creative way.
For the Russians coming out of carrying on a tradition that started with the Soviets, It's anybody who opposes Soviet or Russian control over Ukraine is a follower of Stepan Bandera or a Banderite. It's a term that means something in Ukraine and it means something in Russia, but it means nothing almost anywhere else. Mostly what it is a flag, a big red flag, that this is somebody who's clued into Russian propaganda.
The arguments spread over the internet. Andrew mapped out the relationships between Twitter accounts as they moved from the Mideast and the Syrian war to the politics of Ukraine. Russia began supporting an insurrection in Ukraine's east in 2014. Even as Russia violated Ukraine's sovereignty, global awareness of the situation became more contested, less certain. The use of social media, the brigades of trolls, effectively muddled the international perception of what was happening in Ukraine. Academic Olga Boychuk was in the country at the time.
Russia was very successful in making it seem like there is some portion of Ukrainian population that either did not want to be part of Ukraine or wanted to be part of Russia. And it was very easy to make those associations. So make it seem like all people who speak Russian in Ukraine would want to be Russian citizens.
Russia achieved a kind of sleight of hand about Ukraine conducted at an international scale. And remember, at this time, many democratic governments couldn't really see what was happening. They concerned themselves with cybersecurity, the integrity of networks, not the integrity of content. While evidence of false political propaganda on social media mounted, Western governments struggled to respond. For most of them, it was not even clear what department or authority could respond. We'll talk about this more in a later episode.
There was no interest in the U.S. government's part at that point. This would be, say, 2014. No interest at all, really, in anything related to the Russians. It was just not felt to be important. Nobody really wanted to get involved seriously in Syria. The Russians were already heavily involved in supporting Assad in Syria. The Maidan Revolution in Ukraine came around, was also 2014. But stuff was happening, but there was no interest in it.
With the narratives about Ukraine split in two, for many people, the true nature of the crisis was inconclusive. Were the Ukrainians really demanding their own independence? Or was that just what our governments were telling us? An alternate reality was established around Ukraine.
Even if you look at the socially mediated communication, right, looking at what happened on Facebook, on Twitter, a lot of these things fell under the radar because they seemed very grassroots. They were too small to be noticed. And that was, I guess, the genius of this kind of intervention, of this kind of information operation, that it was really hard to detect.
The proof of concept worked. Russia could effectively divide and paralyze with information. No wonder America came into the Kremlin's sights next.
So stuff was happening, but there was no interest in it. So I got offered a day job at the local university at the police department as their webmaster. And I took a break from doing freelance intelligence work and took a day job and spent my copious spare time, you know, with enjoying a straight 40-hour work week. I had all the time in the world to just focus on what the Russians were up to on my own.
Phil was now back at home in the U.S. He had returned from Afghanistan via a handful of Middle Eastern nations. He was in his apartment. It was late at night. The blue from his computer screen glowed over his face. Phil watched the spectacle unfold on Maidan Square in Kyiv. He saw Russia cranking up the propaganda, the claims that Russia was simply reacting to a U.S.-fomented coup.
For weeks, this European capital has been the scene of a violent uprising. Today, the bloodiest day yet, with more than 70 dead and counting.
We are not terrorists. We are free people that want to live in a free...
Phil saw these competing narratives as well. The news reported one thing. Meanwhile, whole web forums were being taken over by vocal pro-Kremlin voices. He toggled between social media and news, and back to social media.
No, this wasn't good.
What was in the news and what was happening on social media, they no longer corresponded. Phil lingered in front of his computer, moving from Reddit to Facebook to Twitter to Telegram, and then to the news.
The network of websites we discovered while working in Afghanistan the ones that promote Area 51 and JFK assassination theories? Well, they were moving like a school of fish again, this time pivoting to the issue of Ukraine.
He messaged the colleagues he had met in Afghanistan. Were they seeing this too?
Russia's First Channel has stood by a story it put out in July in which it interviewed a woman who said that a young boy had been crucified in the eastern Ukrainian town of Slavyansk by Ukrainian forces.
This blob was growing. The alternative sites, the trolls, the bots, even semi-official Russian channels were unanimous about one thing: Russia's victimhood. The Ukrainian uprising was actually a Western plot against the Kremlin. Ukrainians were being organized by the CIA or NATO. Ukrainian media academic Olga Boychuk.
Once that was established sort of by Russia, it just completely reconfigured our understanding of Russia's invasion back in 2014, because it made it seem like a non-issue, right? And so there's been a lot of these smaller kind of camouflaged efforts, even sending soldiers in unmarked uniforms to take over the government buildings in Crimea. It was all made to look very much unlike any war we've ever seen.
With enough global onlookers divided by the counter-narrative that Russia generated around the Kyiv protests, Russia acted. It sent in well-armed soldiers to essentially occupy the Crimean Peninsula, but with a crucial difference. They had no insignias or patches on their uniforms.
Who is behind the mask? Troops took control of the airport in the Crimean capital. Many believe these are Russian boots on Ukrainian ground.
Can you tell me who you are?
No comment, no.
No comment. Are you Russian troops? Nothing.
This was Maskarovka, the battlefield deception that Russia is famous for, but with a twist. In the internet age, the uncertainty was paralyzing to the international community. That level of disguise, as hokey as it was, prevented the world from calling out the annexation of Crimea by Russia. After all, the international community couldn't exactly denounce a country's behavior if they weren't 100% sure which country was behind it. The lesson for Russia: influence operations work best with a cast of live actors on the ground. Here's the Russian ambassador to the EU discussing the situation.
There are no troops whatsoever, no Russian troops, at least.
What really alarmed Phil, looking at Ukraine, was how effective this alternative reality was. In the US, Phil moved in educated circles. Yet, when the topic of Ukraine came up, many Americans accepted the notion that this was a NATO-backed coup, or that it was about Nazis, or that this was somehow an extension of US imperialism.
That was the genius of this annexation, and that was why it was so effective, because we blinked, nobody understood what was going on. And so that is part of how they work. It's very hard to detect. It doesn't look like we expect it to look, and it's very effective in propagating narratives that would explain it in a different way.
Consider Russia's annexation of Crimea and further aggression in eastern Ukraine. We cannot stand by when the sovereignty and territorial integrity of a nation is flagrantly violated.
And yet, the sovereignty of the U.S. was going to be violated in a matter of months, through interference online and in person. On social media, no one had to accept what traditional news-gathering organizations said about Ukraine. Now, there was an alternative. Russia was all about backing alternatives. And from a subversive perspective, it was perfect. Everyone could follow a different path to their own truth. Peter Tesh, the former Australian ambassador to Russia.
This, if anything, is where Russia, I think, functions at a superior level compared with, say, China. The sophistication that has emerged and evolved over the last two decades in Russia's ability to understand how to exploit the natural fissures, tensions, uncertainties, contestabilities in the sometimes erratic and ill-disciplined Western, to use that perhaps slightly overworked label, democratic system to its own advantage.
All the media had to do was send people down different rabbit holes until public consensus turned to public confusion and finally apathy. What was really going on in Crimea? Where did those unmarked soldiers come from? Who was really behind Ukraine's revolution? Did anyone know? Could they know?
The whole notion that Crimea was anything other than a Russian invasion was ridiculous. It was ludicrous in retrospect that people were afraid to call Russia out because they didn't wear military insignia. We saw how their tactics gave our leadership an excuse not to act.
An alternative reality was conjured and spread. Phil understood the internet as a place of free information and free expression. Here was that freedom being turned back on itself. The freedom of speech used not to get a truth, but to make the truth of a situation impossible to know.
When I was out with friends at night, I'd run into people, totally normal Americans, but who saw the Ukraine issue completely through the eyes of the Russian state.
And up close among Americans, the effect of the Kremlin narratives was stunning.
Often it wasn't a love for Russia or an embrace of the Kremlin. No, it was a cynicism about power and natural skepticism about the U.S. government. It set up an enemy of my enemy is my friend dynamic, using constant repetition to build the perception that the Kremlin was a friend and the U.S. government was the enemy.
The logic in a million internet debates was, if you accept what the media told you, you were naive. Better to be skeptical, even if that meant embracing arguments that dovetailed with the Kremlin's agenda.
If you couldn't accept those arguments, you weren't truly open-minded. You weren't truly free. Democracy was all about freedom, wasn't it? In this way, propaganda from Russian state-friendly websites about Ukraine was laundered into respectability by people in the U.S.
The implications were troubling.
If these useful idiots can effectively provide propaganda cover for kinetic operations there in Ukraine, what can they do here in the U.S.?
What would the defense for this be for the U.S. if it were targeted? The government of the U.S. didn't track this stuff, didn't realize how seductive it was for the public. The U.S. didn't have gangs of patriotic trollers to push back either. The questions presented themselves one after another. Phil and his colleagues couldn't just sit and watch this happen. Given where America's politics were and what Russia was doing, it was all looking like a car crash in slow motion.
What the Russians were doing was working.
Andrew Weisberg was waiting, watching. He soon noticed something new and disturbing. The accounts that had posted about Ukrainian politics, well, they started posting about America's election. And they were swinging in hard for Donald Trump. One Twitter account was even called Team Trump Russia. Andrew documented thousands of reciprocal relationships between at Team Trump Russia and the past pro-Russia groups he had tracked before. Some were from St. Petersburg. Many were located elsewhere, in the US, the UK, the Netherlands. And when you think about it, being located anywhere is kind of what gives trolling its power. It's decentralized. In a loose way, these accounts posted on pro-Kremlin themes and were now posting for Donald Trump. One other thing Andrew noted, these accounts weren't centrally controlled. They seemed to be doing what they thought would please the Kremlin. Andrew and his partners watched, rapt, as Russia directly messed with American politics. He couldn't look away.
It was this slow unfolding nightmare. I don't really know how else to, you know, just watching this happening and watching the sort of the larger American political thing happen.
Andrew and his research partners asked each other.
This isn't happening, is it? It's like, oh yeah, it's happening.
I thought of my encounter with the lone Russian I met in Texas. And that was during Glasnost, the diplomatic good times. I mean, what was to stop Russia from doing something like it did to Ukraine to a Western democracy? Nothing, really. Nothing at all. The U.S. was sitting wide open. The election year approached. Next time on Dark Shining Moment.
Wouldn't it be to have like an independent news source that was funded completely and totally by tax dollars and had nothing to do with any commercials whatsoever?
That's what RT is.
Is that what RT is?
Yeah.
For Russia.
Mm-hmm. Who owns RT?
RT is publicly funded, so it's funded by the Russian government.
Why did they do it, you know?
You know, you would have to ask them.
And how an American community could be mobilized by Russian bots.
In less than 90 days, you had the idea of this thing, that this military exercise was actually a secret internal opposition crackdown in the United States.
Dark Shining Moment is a Ranierian co-production, reported and written by me, Chris Sapone. Sound design by Martin Peralta. Executive producer, Greg Mueller. Consulting producer, Richard Baker. And managing producer, Nick Randall.